Welcome to episode 2 of The Mark of a Druid. My name is Rhonda R. Carpenter. I'm your narrator and author. If you need more information about myself or the book, please go to themarkofadruid.com. Now, on to our story. Chapter 2. The Clinic. Eve pulled into the parking lot just after 1 o'clock, leaving plenty of time before her first client was due. "Good afternoon, Manny." Eve waved to the security attendant as she passed through the gate.
"Afternoon, Miss McCormick," he said with a nod.
She parked the Explorer and gathered her things. Briefcase in hand, Eve entered the building. The elevator doors slid open at the 5th floor, and Eve walked the familiar hallway to Suite 521. "Hey, Eve. You sure are early today. Your first client is not due for an hour. Would you like the rundown of this afternoon's subjects?" The exuberant voice of Lori Katz, the project's administrative assistant, filled the room. Eve smiled and dropped the briefcase on the floor by her feet. She leaned on the almost chest-high counter and said, "Good afternoon, Lori."
"Sure. How was the week? Anything interesting to report?"
As always, Lori's bright blue eyes gleamed at the prospect of filling Eve in on the regression work for the week and any gossip in the building. Eve was never sure how Lori knew everything that happened, but she seemed to, and that was a great quality in an assistant. Lori handed Eve her messages. A stack of small pink slips of paper meticulously filled in correctly. The third in the stack was a call from her old professor, now her mentor and best friend. Andrea McMurray, Ph.D., and her preteen son Richard held a special place in Eve's heart. Eve read the note. "Just want to catch up on the project. Are you available for dinner tomorrow night?" Eve smiled at the thought. It had been 2 months since they'd talked, really talked.
"You have a 2, 3, 4, and 5 today," Lori said. "Can I get you some water?" "Oh, yes, and David left you this."
She handed Eve a cassette tape with a sticky note attached to it. "Eve, this is great background music. Is it possible for us to have dinner? I have some things I need to go over with you. David."
"No, I'll get the water myself. Thanks, Lori. But will you leave David a note to call me? I'll be in my office. Let me know when Charles Agner arrives for his session."
Eve strolled down the hall past several offices. Samantha Page, David Landrum, Lisa Montgomery read the plates, glancing in each only to find them empty and dark. James Forrest's office was brightly lit, and Eve poked her head around the corner.
"Hey, Evie," said James. "I've got some great news."
"What's up?"
"Yesterday we got another confirmation. Not that I doubted that reincarnation was real, mind you," he said with a wink of a blue-green eye.
"Want to tell me now or save it for the meeting next week?" she asked.
"I'm still firming up the copies of the death certificates. I just wanted to let you know that we're adding to the numbers."
"I'll get all the details at the meeting, right?"
"Absolutely, no question about it," he said, the corner of his mouth
twisted into a crooked smile. It crinkled his forehead and caused brown hair to fall into his eyes.
"Great. I have a call to make. Are you in all day?" Eve asked, turning toward the hall.
"Nope, out about 3-ish.
"Okay, have a good day."
Eve went to her office without stopping again. It wasn't much to look at, but it was hers. She dropped her things on the small desk and swiveled the office chair out of the way so she could turn on the desk lamp. Dim light filtered through the room. An overstuffed recliner against the opposite wall awaited her next client. The absence of windows was what she had liked about this space. It kept the lighting control simple. She grabbed some water from the kitchenette and returned to her desk. Eve picked up the telephone and dialed Andrea's cell.
"Hello," answered Andrea.
"Hey, you. I got your message. I'd love to have dinner tomorrow. What time?"
"How about I pick you up at 6?
"We can catch up then. I hear your work's progressing," Andrea said.
"Really? From whom?"
"David Landrum called me last week. He said that things were moving along in the right direction. He had some music he wanted me to listen to, something to do with inducing alpha brainwaves," Andrea said.
"Yes, well, he seems of late to be very interested in background filler music and how it will affect trance. Funny, he should call you, though. I'll tell you all about our progress tomorrow."
"Oh, Andrea, tell that young man of yours Aunt Eve said hi. See you at 6.
"6 it is. See you then, my friend."
Andrea disconnected. Hanging up the phone, Eve envisioned Andrea with her auburn curls, highlighting effervescent emerald eyes, and a sparkling smile that exposed a single dimple on her right cheek. This'll be a lot of fun, she thought. Charles was early as usual. An interesting man in his late 60s, he suffered from an annoying eye twitch for as long as he could remember. Charles had his first session last year. He was a retired engineer from the Army Corps of Engineers and had provided at least 4 different lifetimes, each of which had helped him in some way in his present life. However, he still had the twitch. Hi, Charles. Take a seat. I'm going to start the tape now. Eve smiled and waved him toward the recliner.
Hello, Eve. Will we be working on this twitch?
He let his hand graze the right side of his face. Yes, sir. Just like I promised. Eve gathered the required information for the study and went straight to work. He relaxed into the recliner, pushing all the way back, and made himself comfortable. Eve dimmed the light and went into her standard patter. First, take a long, deep breath and let it out with a sigh. She heard him do so. Good. Now imagine a stairway with 21 steps, each step taking you deeper and deeper, all the way to the hallway of life. She paused to give him time to envision it. Good. Counting him down the stairs one by one, she saw the signs of hypnosis clearly on his face. His jaw went slack, and rapid eye movement increased. Totally relaxed. That's right. Now, one of the doorways or portals that line the hallway will draw your attention. It may appear to be different from the others. One of the doors will take you to a life in which you will learn why you have the twitch. One never knows where a client will go. It could be this lifetime or another, but it's always interesting, she thought. When you have the door, nod your head so I know. She paused and waited for him to do so. Once he did, she continued, Good. Now, Charles, before you open the door and go inside, take a deep breath. This is a place of wisdom, and you will receive your answers here. Now open the door and tell me what you see. He began to describe the vision he saw behind closed eyes. It's a field of wheat, tall and golden. Good. Now look down at the ground and tell me what you see.
I have bare feet. I'm a girl.
His voice revealed his surprise. How old are you? Eve asked. His response was in a higher female tone. I'm 16. My name is Sarah Godfrey Ramsey. Good, Sarah. You're doing great. Tell me, Sarah, what happens now? I'm watching them as they harvest the wheat, stacking it into bales. I'm watching. I brought dinner for Henry. Who's Henry, Sarah? He's my husband. Good. Tell me what year it is. 1902, September. Good. Good. Where are you? I'm in a field. Yes, Eve said with a smile. Of course she's in a field. She almost slapped her own forehead. Where is the field? In Kansas, Troy County, Kansas. What happens next, Sarah? They're stacking the wheat in the cart. Oh, God! No! Henry! Her voice came from Charles's body in a scream of fear. Making a note of the names and location, Eve also noted the sheer terror in the pitch of the female voice. Charles's body remained perfectly relaxed. Even the twitch was not present in his facial muscles. Eve evened her tone, letting the naturally soothing qualities of her voice resonate as she spoke. What happens now, Sarah?
The horses, they rear, and the cart fell on him. Oh, my God! No! Henry! Henry!
Take a deep breath and tell me what happens now, Sarah.
I'm running to the cart. My skirts tangle in the way of my feet, and I fall. I hit my face on a stone.
What happens next? Eve asked, noting a faint muscular twitch near the corner of his right eye.
I drag myself to my knees. My face is twitching. My eye is blinking from the blood. Oh, Henry, no. Please let him be unharmed. I'm trying to run, but the men stop me, holding me back. All I can do is watch, kicking and crying. Tom, our neighbor, releases the harness from the cart. He's tying a rope onto the harness and moving the horses around to the opposite side of the cart. Tom ties the other end of the rope to the cart and slaps the horses. They strain on their haunches. The cart is pulled back onto its wheels. The wheat bales fall to the ground around Henry. One of the men holding me releases his grasp and I get free. I run forward screaming, "No, no, is he alive? Tom, is he alive? Please, let him be alive." Sarah's plea ended in a soft whisper. As I reach him, I can see that he's not breathing. I kneel down beside him and cry. Tom touches my shoulder and says, "Sarah, there's nothing to do. He's gone. You're bleeding, child. Come, I'll take you to Marjorie, and we'll take care of Henry."
With chills running down her back, Eve noted his facial expression, the tone of his voice, and his demeanor. She continued, "Take a deep breath and go even deeper now. View the experience of this lifetime from beginning to end. Tell me what was important about her life." Very slowly, Charles' normal voice replied, "Sarah never remarried after he died. Her face was scarred from the fall. She was left with a twitch in her right eye. No one wanted her, although it didn't matter to her. He was the only man she ever loved. Sarah died of consumption not 2 years after him." "Take another deep breath. You're doing great. Scan your body from top to bottom." Eve noted the time period of Sarah's death, 1904 or 1905, and made a side note about the cause. "Charles, are you holding Sarah anywhere in your body?"
"Yes,"
he said, sounding startled at the idea that he could be holding her physical memory inside his body.
Holding her in my right eye."
Eve was not at all surprised by his response. "Good, Charles. I want you to release the twitch. As long as it's for your best and highest good, tell me what happens when the light comes upon Sarah." Tears streamed down his face, catching at the wrinkles beside his closed eyes.
"She's smiling and waving at me, thanking me for remembering her. She's fading into the light."
"Good. Very good, Charles. Take a deep breath and begin to slowly come back to the room. Zero. Coming back." Eve took a drink of water. "One." She paused, watching Charles's face for any sign of resistance. "Two." She reached for a tissue box, sitting it next to her. She continued to count slowly until she reached five. "Eyes open. Wide awake. Feeling great. Perfect from head to toe. Good job." He sat for a long moment, and Eve watched the hypnotic state slip away from his features. "How are you feeling?" She handed him a tissue, and he wiped his face. He didn't answer for long moments. Then he gathered himself and sat up. He looked up at her wide-eyed and said, "Yes, better than ever." He smiled. "That was the most incredible experience I've ever had, Eve. It was so real. I have lots of information." Eve handed him the clipboard and turned the dimmer switch slowly to an acceptable level for writing. He began to fill out the forms that would close the session. She casually watched his face. Not once in the 15 minutes it took him to fill out the forms did his eye twitch. They made his next appointment, and he left the office, free from the tic that he'd carried for all those years. "Lori, did you notice his eye wasn't twitching?" Eve said with satisfaction, handing over the closing documents that all clients completed after a session.
"Sorry, no, I was on the phone."
Lori took the forms and started glancing over them.
"Eve, look at this. He gave the exact date of death for, Sarah Godfrey Ramsey?
This one looks easily researchable." She waved the papers at Eve with a grin.
"Date? He didn't give me a date."
Eve snatched the forms from Lori's hand with a Cheshire Cat grin. "It never ceases to amaze me that they don't tell you everything that they're experiencing in a trance. This is a great way for us to get even more data." She scanned the rest of what Charles had written with interest. "Look, he even remembered the date of Tom's death. Be sure that Beth runs him, too. And let me know as soon as she gets confirmations in hand." Eve handed the forms over. She was confident about Lori being right. This would be an easy confirmation.
I will, O Great One, Lori laughed.
It seemed oddly familiar, but Eve was sure Lori had never called her that before. She felt like she should be remembering something, but could not get her head around what it would be. Maybe it was Lori's tone that made Eve uncomfortable.
I'll be in my office, O Great and Powerful Assistant, Eve giggled. Let me know when my next client gets here.
As she turned toward the office, that morning's dream flooded back into her mind. Eve sat at her desk and slipped the tape that David had left her in the cassette player. The sound of a soft, lilting flute gently filled the room. Lori's words rang in her head. Oh, Great One. Eve placed her head in her hands, feeling dizzy. The lightheadedness rushed over her in waves. She closed her eyes. Her stomach heaved. She thought she was going to be sick. Inconsistent shapes in shades of purple and gold flashed on her retinas. Eve had the oddest sensation of movement. Then it seemed as if all turned gray and hazy. She struggled to open her eyes, but the harder she tried, the tighter they closed, until Eve gave up. The moon waxed, turned full, then waned, and was reborn anew after Knut's announcement that he was not Alion's father, and she still did not believe him. Granted, he, the great man, the would-be king, had seen the village settled, likely the only thing that would keep them alive in the coming months. She could not understand how he could leave them to the wilds of the Welsh countryside, with its dense forests and rocky terrain. Growing anything would be a challenge, one of the farmers had pointed out to him, but the complaint fell on deaf ears. Every family, no matter its station, fashioned round wattle and dub houses, each with a circular fire pit at its center. The village had come a very long way in a very short time. The central house would be completed in the morning, when the last of the roof was thatched and tarred. The villagers were exhausted. The children gathered firewood for the evening meal. An arrow, blessed by the gods, snagged a deer, and fresh venison soaked in goat's milk had been divided and distributed to each hearth. The Bjila was helping a man who had cut his hand earlier in the day, while Athene and Alion carried the torches to the house. There were still no beds constructed, but Alion had managed to gather a large quantity of pine needles for stuffing the sleeping mats. She lit the fire and settled the cooking pot over the flames, adding in the wild onions she discovered earlier in the day. Then she placed the meat inside the pot to braise. Athene sang as she filled the sleeping mats.
What is that song, Athene?
I don't know, Alion. I am making it up.
"'Tis very pretty. Hum louder," she asked, grinning at her younger sister.
Athene smiled back at her and raised the volume of her tune. Alion flipped the meat over and then knelt to help Athene with the stuffing. Soon, the sisters were both humming Athene's wordless tune and giggling to one another. The singing, however, came to an abrupt stop when the door swung open and their father stepped inside. Athene ran toward him, and Alion watched him lift her sister into the air, cradling her in his arms and whispering to her softly that he needed mead. Alion stood to fetch it for him so that he would not have to release her little sister. She knew that it would be a very long time before Athene would feel the safety of his arms around her again. Alion handed him the horn cup, filled to the rim with honeyed brew. He did not acknowledge her with anything more than a grunt, never meeting her eyes. He drank deeply and set Athene on the floor, patting her on the bottom as she went back to work stuffing the mats. Alion tended dinner and refilled his cup several times before Dubjila came in with an armload of lavender and a jug. She set these on the rough planked table. The old healer seemed bothered by the presence of the girl's father, but said nothing to him. The smell of venison cooking filled the room, and the rumbling of her father's stomach made Alion realize that she, too, was hungry. Dubjila stuck her nose above the pot and inhaled.
"Oh, great one, where did you get the onions?" said Dubjila. "Oh, great one," Alian's father mumbled, casting Dubjila a threatening look. She straightened her spine and glared back at him.
"I found them, along with a good-sized patch of wild carrots, just beyond the trees to the north, Dubjila."
Alian smiled to herself about the find. There had been no time to make bread, but Alian felt good about the meal that she laid upon the table. Her father had not eaten with them since their arrival to this new place. They ate in silence.
"The ships are making ready to sail within the setting of two suns," he said as he pushed the wooden plate back from his place at the table.
"How long will you be gone, father?"
Athene asked, wiping her chin on her sleeve. Alian already knew the answer, but bit her bottom lip, waiting for him to speak.
"It will be a very long time, Athene. I must fight for the throne if I'm to follow in my father's place. While I'm gone, Dubjila will tend you. By the time you become a woman, I shall be king."
Alian had always been Athene's formal caretaker. That is how her mother had wanted it. The thought of his last statement to her, that he was not her father, brought tears to her eyes. She quickly rose and cleared the table so that her father would not see her as weak. She would not let him see her cry. Dubjila followed her, placing her hand on the girl's shoulder, gently pressing her thumb into the birthmark as she leaned forward and whispered in the young girl's ear,
"Child, you're still her guardian. Until the time comes, you must seek your destiny. Fret not, O great one."
The old woman's eyes twinkled with the love and understanding of a mother, which is what Dubjila had been to Alian since the death of her own mother, Aroke, and the birth of her sister, Athene. Alian could not recall a time that she had not known Dubjila. Taking in the old healer's words, Alian rolled her shoulders back with pride, and she finished cleaning up from the meal. Athene stayed and spoke with her father, but Alian drove his voice from her mind with a song her mother had sung when she was small. The sound of the telephone ringing came as if it was lightning striking steel. A single word sounded in Eve's head.
"Father."
The dizziness faded as she answered the phone. "Yes," she said, reaching for the water on her desk. "Eve, Cheryl Harding is here. Would you like me to send her back?"
"Cheryl? She's not due until 5.
Eve glanced at the clock. It was 5.
God, where had the time gone?
For that matter, where had she gone?
"Are you okay? Your 3 and 4 both canceled. I just didn't bother you. You looked like you were fighting a headache last time I stuck my head in your office."
"Yes, I'm fine. Thanks, Lori." Eve still felt a bit dizzy. "Send her back." She sat the phone in the cradle and wondered about the last 2 hours. Had she been asleep? It didn't matter. Eve could not afford to have her mind on anything but her client. She pushed the disorientation to the back of her mind to be dealt with later, and then stood and moved to the door to greet Cheryl.
"Cheryl, how are you?"
Eve asked.
"I'm well, and you?"
"Better than usual," she lied.
"Are you ready to begin?"
"Take a seat in the recliner," she said, motioning her to the chair as she swapped the tapes in the cassette player.
"I'll just start the tape and, we can do the intake."
Cheryl sat down and arranged her long skirt around her ankles.
"All right.
Push all the way back in the chair," Eve said. "Make yourself comfortable and take a long, deep breath." She ambled through her normal patter, and soon Cheryl was standing before the doorway in the hallway of life. Eve made several notes as she told Cheryl to open the door and look at the ground. Her client's response was immediate.
"I'm standing on stone, wearing lightweight sandals on my feet, and a bracelet in the shape of a jaguar on my arm. I'm overlooking the great stone city."
"Are you male or female?" Eve asked.
"I'm female."
"How old are you?"
"I don't know."
That's not good." Eve made a note. It's hard to track someone if they don't know how old they are, she thought.
"It is time," Cheryl whispered as if to herself.
"What is it time for? What may I call you?" This time, Cheryl spoke in a language Eve did not understand.
She glanced at the tape to be sure that it was recording.
"I need to speak to Cheryl," Eve asked.
Cheryl's voice crept out of the broken dialect.
"I'm here, Eve. Cheryl, you can now have this experience in English. Do you understand?"
"Yes, I understand."
"Good. Take a deep breath and tell me what I can call you."
"There was a great storm the year of my birth. The wind howled and the rains fell. The crops drowned. When I was born, the rain stopped and the sun returned to us. But the wind continued to blow. So they named me Wind."
Eve made a note of the name, but feared that there would be no way to track it down.
"Good, Wind. Where are you?"
"I am in Chichen Itza. My people are preparing for the feast of Chuck-Ix-Buck."
"Okay, this is going to be impossible to prove." Eve jotted down all of the names, spelling them phonetically, and made a note to get the tape to a linguist. If the language was in current use, maybe it could be identified.
"What's happening now?" Eve asked.
"I am taking the sacrifice to the Well of Souls. She is to be given to the priest."
"Tell me what happens next."
"I am standing at the altar. The priest is raising his knife. I can see that the herbs have worked, for there is no fear in the young girl's eyes. I must stop this. No more can we kill our young women. There are far too few of us."
"What do you do?" Eve asked.
"Nothing. It is too late to stop the blade from cutting open her chest. His aim is true. The blood and air are flowing from her body in a rush. Her eyes widen as the life seeps from her. He grasps her still beating heart, cutting it from her chest. Then, with clear deliberation, he turns to the crowd, holding it up as far as his arm will reach. The blood is everywhere. On him, on the stone, on the child. And I allow myself a single tear. The high priest holds her heart to his mouth and bites down. Muscle rips. Blood spews across the front of my gown. He drinks her life force. He places the remains into a bowl in my trembling hands. I pass the bowl to the elders and regret my lack of action. The high priest lets the axe fall to the victim's throat. The child's head severs in one stroke of his blade. I reach into the warmth of the bloody pool gathered on the stone altar. Lifting my hand to my face, I smear the blood across my cheek and down my throat to my heart. I vow in this moment never to let anyone harm another child. The bearers of souls fling her lifeless body into the sacred well so the child can make her way to the underworld. The lifeless head is being shown to all present, and I myself am the one to toss it into the well. Eve shivered at the images and felt her stomach churn at Cheryl's words. She wrote what Cheryl said as fast as she could, knowing that this lifetime was likely unverifiable by the standard means of date or death certificate. However, the foreign language was fascinating to her. Cheryl's body movements and hand gestures were clear examples of the happenings she was experiencing in trance. Eve noted all of them and asked her final questions. "Wind, how do you come to help Cheryl at this time in her life?"
"She must heed the oath."
"Cheryl, how can you do this?"
Eve asked.
Cheryl's voice was strong and clear. "I," she said, "will make the call."
"What call, Cheryl?"
"My neighbor's a mean and vicious man who drinks to excess. On the weekends, I've heard his rantings, and I believe he's beating his children. I've hesitated on many occasions to call the authorities."
"Good. So you'll make the call?"
"Yes." At once, her body became less rigid. Eve brought Cheryl out of trance with a simple count from 0 to 5. While Eve finished the closing documents, Cheryl said little. Eve understood why she was quiet. The experience was very traumatic for them both, and Eve was not even seeing what Cheryl was. Eve walked her to the front desk. She made her next appointment, and they said their goodbyes.
"Tell me, Lori," Eve said, leaning on the reception counter, "was I sitting up when you came into my office?"
Did I say anything?
Lori tilted her head, sideways, thinking.
Yes, she said. You had your head in your hands. I didn't hear you say anything. Why?
No reason. That morning's dream flooded her mind as she gathered her things to go home. She left, determined to rip that dream apart.
Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of The Mark of a Druid, and stop back again. Pick up the next episode at rhondacarpenter.com or themarkofadruid.com. So until next time, thanks, and take care.